Abel once and shrugged. Well, normally I'd send one of the regular agents to handle this sort of field work. However, it has come to my attention that you might be involved in something of a pet project of mine. Macy didn't respond. She just watched Goring. Watched him like you might watch the approach of a big black dog loose on the street. He smiled, but there wasn't much nice about it anymore. Macy, allow me to be the first to lay the cards out on the table. You know how in poker, when both sides are all in, they show their cards? The smile got edgy for a moment. That's where we're at, because we both have something that the other wants. In your case, you want your freedom. Macy felt a blind, white-hot fear shoot up her spine.
I didn't do anything wrong. You can't hold me.
On the contrary, Goring waved off her protests like flies. I can do anything I want when it comes to our national security. And as far as you not doing anything wrong, well, we're getting a different story from your friend down the hall. Macy's jaw worked, but she found her mouth suddenly dry. Macy Stockwell, Goring said in the tone of a jury foreman reading a verdict to the court. You've knowingly harbored domestic terrorists at your place of residence. You've failed to notify a government representative, such as myself, in a timely manner that you were in contact with a domestic terrorist. And you've rendered medical aid to not just one of them, but two. Goring held up four fingers. He looked at them like they were marvelous treats, then displayed them to Macy. Four charges, Macy. Any one of those four puts you securely in DTI for the rest of your life. And that's just what I found out about from 30 minutes of talking to James over there. He slapped his hand down on the table and his eyes narrowed. Imagine what else I'll come up with when I do a little digging. Macy's eyelids fluttered, and her lungs started to hurt, started to want more and more air.
I was coerced. I had to. I was afraid.
Oh, afraid. Bullshit. Goring shook his head in disgust. Do you really mean to tell me that you had two renegade new breeds in your apartment for weeks, and they let you freely go to and from work, and never in all that time that they were in your house and you were at your work, which is 27 miles away, Macy? I know, I checked. At no time in all of that did you ever feel safe enough to pick up a fucking phone and call the police? Macy's eyes were wide and her mouth open, breathing, chest rising and falling rapidly. Goring loomed over the table and his voice became quiet and menacing. You had a relationship with Kozlowski. You did. Don't deny it. It's on the fucking paperwork. And I don't know what your reasons were for doing what you did, but I can tell you one thing. There's not a reason in the world you can pull out of your ass that can keep me from sending you to DTI. Do you understand me? Macy nodded her head, her hair falling in her face, and she tried hard not to let tears come to her eyes. But she was just so goddamn scared at that moment that she couldn't think straight, couldn't think with any sense of self-respect. Goring nodded along with her. You want your freedom. You want your life back. And I can give it to you, Macy. But there are things that I want, and the only way that you get what you want is when I get what I want. Am I clear on that? Do we both see each other's cards?
Yes,
Macy managed. Goring stayed where he was, hovering over her, staring her straight in the eye. I want Walter Baucom. Chapter 22. As plans went, it was relatively simple. It was all dependent, however, on a few items of equipment that needed to be begged, borrowed, or stolen in order for it to work. Getty and Bobby were tasked with the stolen part. Stealing in broad daylight? Actually not all that uncommon. And Bobby'd had some practice during her time sneaking around for the Honeycutt organization. Getty was there to watch her back. The two of them were in the small sedan that had transported them and the new breeds out of Durham when Mel's headquarters had been assaulted. It was a little worse for wear. The sides of it were pale with concrete dust from destroyed buildings. There were some dents and dings in it, too. And it had a large crack in the windshield that no one could remember actually cracking. It also still smelled heavily of man sweat. Something that had escaped Getty when he'd first jumped in it a day ago. At the time, he'd been somewhat distracted by trying not to die. Getty drove the sedan, and Bobby sat in the passenger seat. They were headed east. They didn't want to go into a city to find what they were looking for. Because Durham was currently burning, and it looked like Raleigh was next, most cities were on high alert, and their police forces were too keyed up to be fucked with. The safe house was located close to the border of District 89, but that place was still too hot. with too many troops still patrolling the streets while government contractors put the wrecked town center back together. They weren't likely to find what they were looking for there, and they stood a good chance of running into trouble while searching. So they were heading east, to Agrarian District 88, which was 89's neighbor, out in the flatlands as he moved towards the coast of North Carolina. It was smaller than 8089, but it was still a district, so it still had a town center. It also gave them the added advantage of being removed from where they were actually doing the operation. It was pretty much a rule that you didn't go around stealing things anywhere within the proximity of the place you were going to do an operation. They knew when they were there, not because of any signage that told them they were entering an agrarian district. No signage was necessary. You knew it when it happened, especially out here in the east. The roads leveled out, straightened. The trees disappeared almost completely. Fields stretched like oceans. Corn, about waist high now, so you couldn't see the tractor rails or the hydroponics lines or the regulator posts. The day outside of their car was still and warm, and there wasn't a breeze to move anything, so it sat like a big green painting, undisturbed, as they drove by. Getty glanced over to Bobby. The woman was leaning up against the door, her head propped up on her hand, her eyes heavy and tired.
"How you feeling today?"
She blinked, looked at him, straightened.
"I'm good, actually,"
she said in that prim way of hers.
"Much better than yesterday. Honestly, I think it's the drugs that are making me tired at this point. I feel like I've slept more than I've been awake."
"You needed it."
She gave a terminal smile to the windshield. They drove in silence for a while. Getty shifted in his seat and thought about a cigarette, but Bobby didn't appreciate the smoke, and since he was dealing with a head injury and all...
"Do you miss Rat?"
Bobby asked. Getty's grip on the steering wheel tightened.
"Yes."
"I feel like we never got time to, I don't know, mourn, I guess."
And they hadn't. He'd been there, and then he'd been gone, and then they'd been fighting. And the only time he came back to them was when they lay awake at night, staring at the ceiling and feeling the darkness like a sickness coming over them.
"I miss them all," Getty said. "Rat especially, but the other guys too."
He glanced at her.
"I miss Virgil."
He cracked a smile.
"Hell, I even miss Tria. Miss the two of them going at each other all the time. I mean, it was tense in the moment, but in retrospect..."
Bobby nodded.
"He did try to save her."
Getty stopped smiling. Bobby frowned.
"Isn't that strange? Two people that absolutely hated each other, but they died trying to save each other's lives."
Getty just kept driving. He swallowed. Didn't like the images his mind was remembering. Bobby let out a long, quiet breath.
"It's just me and you,"
she said in a low voice.
"We're the only ones left."
Getty wanted that cigarette.
"Yeah."
"How'd we come to this?"
Bobby asked him.
"How did it all come down to this?"
"Bits and pieces, I guess," Getty said. "Small steps over entire generations. Eventually, some generation has to pay the price for going so off course. I guess that's our generation."
"It'll happen again,"
Bobby said.
"Won't it? It seems like it always does."
She looked out the window.
"Somewhere along the line, in the next generation after us, or maybe the one after that, they'll prefer comfort to freedom. And then another coax will come along, with some other name and some other method, and then it'll have to be repeated. Everything we lost, it'll have to be lost again. I wish that wasn't the case. I wish that what we're sacrificing could change things forever. But it won't, because the pain gets forgotten."
She looked at him.
"We'll be forgotten."
Getty nodded.
"The tree of liberty must occasionally be watered with the blood of tyrants and patriots alike."
"Who said that?"
Getty shrugged.
"Some old freedom fighter way back when. Someone who's been forgotten."
Bobby looked ahead and frowned.
"Sometimes I don't want to water the tree of liberty, Getty. Sometimes I just want to have a normal life."
Getty reached across on a sudden impulse and he took Bobby's hand. For half a second, he thought that his impulse was going to create something awkward. But when his hand grabbed hers, she grabbed his back, and she held on to him with surprising force.
"This is normal," Getty said finally. "This is normal for us."
Bobby surprised him by picking up his hand, his right hand, with the nicotine-stained fingers, and she kissed the back of it with genuine affection, and then she laid it back down.
"You're right,"
she said, and her voice was firmer.
"You're always so steady."
"Well," Getty replied.
"I'm good.
Bobby said, as though making a decision.
I'm good. Let's do what we came to do.
They found what they wanted in the back half of the town center of District 88. They'd been driving as inconspicuously as possible down the back streets of the town center for 20 minutes without seeing anything, but then Bobby leaned forward and pointed out the windshield.
There. Perfect.
It was pulled in at the back of a building. It was a commercial building, but they didn't know what it was. Some sort of store, perhaps. In any case, the building didn't have windows in the back, and that was the key. Getty started looking around, judging the area to see if there was anyone else around. The sidewalks looked clear.
Just pull in right beside it, Bobby said.
Getty guided the sedan into place. Bobby looked out her window and checked her target out with a practiced eye. It was a red panel van. Old red. Rusted red. Like blood left on concrete. Bobby's left hand hovered near her door latch, while the other held the object that Gibbs had loaned her from the new breed's gear. A dialing wand. As Getty pulled their sedan into place, Bobby could crane her neck and see inside the front window of the van. She thought maybe there would be someone inside, someone taking a break or waiting for another person to come out of the back of the building. But it was empty.
All right,
Bobby said, unlatching her door.
Watch my back.
Will do. She stepped out and let her door close behind her. She moved casually. Getty peeled his eyes off of her and started checking his mirrors. It was difficult to restrain his urge to check on her progress, but he knew it would be pointless. His eyes needed to be used for watching her six, not uselessly staring at what she was doing as though he could will her to move faster. Besides, they'd done this sort of thing before. The only difference now was, well, the stakes were higher. Back in the day when it was Getty and Rat and Bobby and Virgil doing ops, they'd worked in an environment that was cautious, but not quite paranoid. The Kulaks was looking for resistance back then, and they certainly would have been sent to DTI or killed if they'd been caught, but it still wasn't anywhere close to today. Today, the world around them was on high alert. Small mistakes that could be brushed off in the past would get them killed now. There were more gunships, more gun trucks, and more soldiers on all the streets than there had ever been before, and the citizens themselves had their PDs on a hair trigger ready to call a federal official the second they saw something amiss in order to save themselves from suspicion. So Getty checked his mirrors. His eyes coursed over them quickly but carefully. And then he looked at the back doors of the building. He checked each and every one of them. To make sure they weren't moving. To make sure they weren't cracked. To make sure that some worker wasn't watching them on the sly. But all was quiet. Until the van's engine came to life. The noise of it turning over sparked in Getty's fingertips. He looked to the right and saw Bobby giving him the thumbs up. He nodded back to her and went into reverse. He pulled back out on the street, and the rust-red panel van settled into place behind him, and they drove nonchalantly out of that town center. When they were in the clear, Getty flipped his PD monitor up and made the call. It was Walter who answered.
How's it going?
Good, Getty replied, peeking in the rearview mirror at the van.
We got item number one, and we're on our way back to you.
In a city where a good portion of buildings had been pummeled by coalition bombs, finding steel I-beams was not difficult. Finding I-beams that were not mangled was.
Here.
Gibbs tapped his knuckle against the glass of his window. Kaz drove the pickup truck. Actually, it was one of the technicals under Carolyn's command that they'd borrowed, but they'd ripped the gun and the gun mount out of the back. Since they were just perusing for I-beams, they didn't want to randomly become a target for drones and get a mini-bomb dropped on their ass as they poked through Durham's remains. Of course, a drone could always just zoom in, see a pair of new breeds out of uniform in the red zone, maybe even catch their faces and identify them, and decide to drop the mini-bombs anyways. But risks had to be taken. Kaz hoped that they had mitigated the risk as much as possible. He pulled to the side of the road. The pickup trundled over some large chunks of fallen brick and stopped with one wheel up on the curb.
Yeah, Gibbs nodded. Those'll do, don't you think?
Kaz made a face.
Sure, if we can get them out of there.
Oh, we can get them out.
All right, let's do it.
Kaz tossed the pickup into park and left it running. The two new breeds unassed the vehicle and got to work. Gibbs started clearing some of the rubble out of the way of the two fallen I-beams that had once supported a concrete floor. The concrete was mostly demolished, but the I-beams were attached in a crossweb, which was a problem. Kaz reached into the pickup bed and retrieved the portable plasma cutter. It was a tad bulky to be considered portable, but he gathered it all up into his arms and huffed it over to the I-beams. It took them 15 minutes, but they managed to liberate three sections of I-beam, each about 8 feet in length.
Think that's enough?
Gibbs said, breathing hard from pulling the last piece out of the way. Kaz eyeballed what they had and then looked around, and he really didn't want to be out here any longer. They were pushing their luck as it was. You don't just hang around like this in the red zone. That had been made clear to them by several resistance fighters that had been operating in Durham. They didn't need to be told. It was something they'd already figured. Sometimes the resistance forgot that a year ago, it was people like Kaz and Gibbs that were hunting them down so efficiently. So Kaz was quite intimate with how quickly your life could be forfeit if you stayed in the same place too long. He did some quick math in his head and cut off the plasma cutter.
Yeah, that'll be enough. More than enough. Let's get it loaded and get the fuck out of here.
It took them another 3 minutes to get the I-beams in the truck. Kaz kept an eye on the sky the entire time. They hopped back in the truck with a sense of urgency. Gibbs wiped at his brow.
Oof, he commented. Shit made me perspire. You're getting out of shape, Kaz said, doing his best to hide his own elevated breathing.
Gibbs snorted.
Still 300 pounds of twisted steel and sex appeal. You, on the other hand, always growing that beard to cover up your man fat. It's disgusting, really.
Kaz smiled as he pulled away and made a call on his PD.
We got the I-beams, he told Walter on the other end. On our way now.
Carmichael stood with Hughes. They stood in front of a large table that had been constructed solidly out of scrap 2x4s and polyboard sheeting, held together with machine screws. This was in sort of a basement storage area underneath the loading docks of the Fresh Market. You had to take the freight elevator down to it. It was dim and cool. On the other side of the table was a man with a distrustful look on his face. Carmichael gestured to the man's PD.
You're welcome to call her if you like.
The man was what Carmichael guessed went for an armorer around here, and he was not too keen on delivering to Carmichael the grocery list of items that Stephanie Udy, Carolyn to everyone else apparently, but Carmichael still thought of her as Ms. Udy, had asked for. Perhaps she should have called down ahead of their arrival and pre-approved it. Hughes stood, watching the two of them, smiling.
Can't say I have her personal contact, the armorer said.
Carmichael pointed to his own PD.
Would you like me to call her?
How's I know it's really her?
Carmichael looked to the ceiling.
You could just take my word for it.
Listen, Carmichael,
the armorer said, which only served to irritate Carmichael further, because the man was acting like he knew Carmichael when in fact he didn't. And if he did, he would know that Carmichael was the liaison between Stephanie and Honeycutt, Honeycutt being the man who this armorer ultimately worked for.
We've got rules in place, the armorer said. Rules that Ms. Udy herself put in place. And I can't just release stuff to you without authorization.
Hughes could see that Carmichael was getting frustrated. He leaned in, putting his hand on the table where the two boxes of ammunition had been brought forward but were not being released.
So,
Hughes looked around as though wrestling with a mystery. You won't release the ammunition without authorization from Ms. Udy, and you don't have a way to get authorization from Ms. Udy. And you refuse to believe Carmichael when he says he has authorization from Ms. Udy, and you'd refuse to believe him if he called Ms. Udy and got authorization over the line. Is all of that right? The armorer narrowed his gaze at Hughes but didn't respond. Hughes maintained his congenial smile.
Where are we supposed to go from here? Does Ms. Udy have to be here to sign off on every bullet you take out of storage?
No.
Then can you give us the ammunition?
No.
What would happen if we just took it?
The armorer swallowed, thought about it.
Well, I'd have to report you, I guess.
Report us to who?
To command.
Which ultimately is Ms. Udy,
Hughes pointed out. Again, the armorer was silent, and his silence was assent.
I can live with that, Hughes said and grabbed the ammunition cans.
Carmichael held up his hand.
Hold on. There's more we need.
Hughes set the ammo cans back, disappointed. The armorer wasn't sure what to do with himself. He was supposed to get what was requested of him, but he wasn't supposed to release this stuff to people without authorization. And no one had given him authorization, except that Ms. Udy had told him to give the squad leaders whatever they needed. The only problem was that these two guys weren't squad leaders. It was quite the conundrum.
Here, Carmichael said. Why don't we do this? Why don't you get the items on our list, and I'll see if I can't get Ms. Udy down here to personally approve it. But let's not waste her time by making her wait for you to gather the stuff. Let's have it here on the table, ready to go when she gets here. Okay?
The armorer nodded. He thought it was a good idea.
Super,
Carmichael said in a voice that suggested he didn't feel like it was super.
I need 3 pounds of whatever plastic explosive you have in this place. I need 10 feet of deck cord. I need 2 programmable remotes. I need 10 blasting caps. Are you getting all this?
The man nodded. Carmichael looked dubious.
All right, well, how about we start with that, and I'll see if I can get Ms. Yudi down here.
The armorer nodded and turned away, glad to be able to do something to placate the situation. He hurried off into the storage room that was his domain. Carmichael let out a sigh. He stood there, didn't move. Hughes looked around, then looked at Carmichael.
You gonna call Ms. Yudi?
Carmichael made a face.
Fuck no.
Hughes just nodded.
So we're just gonna grab it and run?
No, Carmichael replied. We're gonna grab it and walk.
Works for me.
The armorer returned with a crate and set it on the table. It had the requested demolition items compiled in orderly stacks. The armorer appeared proud of his work.
Is Ms. Yudi on her way? He asked.
Carmichael nodded.
Yeah, sure. One more thing. What's that?
The armorer was now ready to please.
I need a man-pack launcher, loaded.
Okay. Make sure it's in good order.
All right.
The armorer turned. And we need shape charge rounds for it.
Ooh, don't know how many of those we have.
I'll take whatever you have.
Okay.
Hurry, please, Carmichael said, tapping an imaginary watch on his wrist.
Miss Yudi will be here any minute.
The armorer hustled off. Carmichael and Hughes stood in silence, waiting for his return. The armorer hustled back, carrying the large black case that contained the launcher. He hoisted it onto the table with a grunt and pointed to it.
Rounds are in with the launcher.
Thank you. One more thing. A flash of annoyance on the armorer's face.
And what's that?
A case of stun balls. The armorer frowned.
I don't think we have those. I don't think we have any less lethal, if that helps.
Carmichael stared at him, affronted. The armorer absorbed the stare, uncomfortable. Carmichael pointed to the storage room.
Can you go check?
The armorer frowned, but he obeyed, and he turned and went to go check. Carmichael waited until he had disappeared around the corner. Then he turned and grabbed the case of demolitions equipment, on which he stacked one of the ammunition boxes.
That should keep him busy for a minute. You take the other ammunition box and the launcher.
Hughes nodded with appreciation.
Well played. Thank you.
Hughes took the launcher and the second case of ammunition, and the two of them walked out unhurriedly. Chapter 23. The 12 of them convened in a quiet corner of the loading docks in Carolyn's supermarket-turned-rebel hideout. 6 new breeds, Walter and Carolyn, Getty and Bobby, and Carmichael and Hughes. Javon counted heads, and he smiled when they'd all assembled.
Oh, he said with a sort of reverence in his voice. There's 12 of us.
His eyes sparkled in the light of the single halogen that hung overhead. The loading bay doors were closed, but they wouldn't have provided any light anyways. The sun was on its way down, and Durham was sinking into darkness. Their private area was a sort of room constructed from old pallets and leftover plywood. Javon and Kaz looked at each other, nodding. Then all 6 new breeds nodded.
Dirty dozen, Javon whispered.
Fuck yeah, Kaz responded.
Dirty dozen, intoned Gibbs and Harris at the same time.
Dirty fucking dozen, was Monty's hushed contribution.
Walter waited for an explanation, but none was forthcoming. He'd grown somewhat accustomed to cryptic inside jokes between the new breeds, like they spoke their own language. But since this involved everyone, Walter's curiosity was more piqued than normal.
Care to explain the significance of that?
Javon still looked pretty pleased.
It's lucky, that's all.
Amen. Amen.
Hallelujah.
Praise be.
Walter's eyes cast around at the 6 giants standing across from him. He still didn't get it, but it seemed like they did, and he felt a spike in the energy level of the exhausted group, and he didn't really care why it was happening. They needed it. He raised his hands to the sky.
Well, glory in the highest, then.
Javon grinned.
That's good. That's a good one.
Getty twiddled an unlit cigarette in his fingers.
I'm fucking lost.
Walter shrugged.
Yeah, me too.
Kaz took a half step forward and gestured respectfully to Carolyn.
It's your house, Carolyn. You want to start us off?
Carolyn looked at Walt and nodded to him.
Actually, I've been putting out fires all day, trying to keep this place on the rails, so I myself am a little out of the loop. Walter's been the one coordinating. I'll let him do the talking.
Walter heard the fatigue in her voice. It was difficult to continue to operate at this physical and mental intensity when you didn't know when you were going to be able to stop. The only time you got a break was when you went to sleep, and typically your brain was so overcharged that it just kept right on going as your body passed out, and you woke up with a brain that felt stretched and used up and unrested. It was hard for him to see her like that. He wanted to keep her from it, but he couldn't. They were both in it, up to their necks. "Yeah," he mumbled, then cleared his throat. "Van's in the shop with the I-beams. Welder's gonna work through the night to get it outfitted as we requested."
"You tell him to keep his mouth shut?" Kaz asked.
Walter nodded. "OPSEC. He's aware. And I told him as little as possible."
Kaz appeared mollified.
Walter turned to Clay and Monty. "Guys, your spot welders will be stationed in the van tomorrow. Get your hands on those ASAP when we prepare to shove off. Our welder says that they're idiot-proof, but..."
Clay smiled good-naturedly. "But we all pretty fucking dumb." The gathered dozen chuckled. They laughed because they knew it was patently false. The body mods did more than just swell muscles and thicken your skeletal structure. They also had a proven positive impact on cognitive function. Walter held up a hand as though to call a truce.
"Just make sure you're familiar with the controls."
"If they're at least partially similar to the ones we've used in the past," Clay said, "then we'll be okay."
"Good." Walter moved on. "The equipment and ordnance for tomorrow is being stored in Carolyn's room here, because she's got a lock on it and people don't go in there. It's the safest place for them. We'll bring it out and get geared up right before we leave."
"What time?" Getty asked, finally giving in to temptation and lighting his cigarette.
"Early," Walter answered. "I want everyone up by 0400. We're gonna assemble and issue gear at 0430. I want to be out the door by 0500. The OLC is 24 hours, but we want to get there at minimum staffing. Once we're on the road, we're heading straight in. Given the routes we gotta take to get there, it's gonna be a 45-minute drive."
Everyone nodded their assent and comprehension.
"Javon," Walter pointed to him, "you're driving. You don't leave the wheel. I'm sorry you can't join the fun, but..."
Javon lifted the stump of his arm.
"I get it. Enough said."
"Bobby, you're in the front seat with Javon. I know he can still fight even though he's down an arm, but he needs an extra set of eyes. You guys are going to be at the entrance to our assault, so you're most likely to receive the first response."
Bobby nodded, quiet and focused.
"Getty and I will go in behind the new breeds and mule out the money. As for the assault itself, Kaz, you've already briefed your team, and there's nothing I can add to that."
Walter turned to Carolyn.
"The rest is yours."
Carolyn nodded. She looked at Carmichael and Hughes.
"Us three are going to be here during the operation. Hughes, you're going to be monitoring and reporting any traffic or any attention whatsoever. Comms, drones, satellite, I don't care. If it can possibly negatively affect this operation, we want to know about it."
Hughes nodded confidently.
"Carmichael?"
Carolyn addressed the man.
"I need you maintaining the appearance of regular operations from the rest of the resistance. I need orders and operations and objectives to continue to come out of here and for our ground forces to be continuously engaged. If there's a lull in activity, it's only going to get the coax elements keyed up. We need to make them feel like it's business as usual, which in the case of Durham means a bunch of building-to-building fighting."
Carolyn pointed to herself.
"I'll be trying to keep an eye on both the resistance forces and the operation and possibly coordinate the two."
Carolyn looked at the new breeds that were slated for the assault team.
"We've installed a small tracking device in the vehicle we're using tomorrow, so I should be able to track your location in real time. If shit does go sideways, I plan on having some trusted elements in the general vicinity that I can move in to assist you guys if necessary, but hopefully we won't have to use them."
Walter nodded along as his wife spoke. When she was finished, there was a brief silence, and Walter knew that this was the conclusion of their meeting. His eyes traveled across the people that were gathered around him.
"I know you know, but I have to say it anyways. In and out. Quick. Violent. New breeds, get yourselves on camera. Sell the coax on the fact that the Renegades are moving to take over Durham. Take the money and run. That's all this is."
"Easy day," Kaz said.
The others nodded.
"Easy day," they intoned.
"All right then," Walter said. "I'll see everyone back here at 0430.
The bombs were falling again that night. Close and then far away. Thump thump, they would sound distantly, and then boom boom somewhere close by, perhaps within a mile or so of them, close enough to send a tremor through the walls of the Fresh Market. This was the soundtrack that Walter and Carolyn lay to.
They knew there might never be another chance for them, but that didn't help assuage the weird awkwardness that they both felt. Or maybe it was just Walter. He was having a hard time figuring whether Carolyn felt the same way. He was having a hard time reading her, which he'd never had before. Part of it was his exhaustion, but part of it was something else, something different, either in him or in her, or perhaps in both of them. And it hurt him in a way that he didn't expect, as they sat together in the manager's office, which had become Carolyn's room, on the mattress that served as her bed, with their backs against the wall, literally and figuratively. It felt like losing something that you held dear. It felt like watching that thing get destroyed and not knowing how to stop it from happening. The fact that both of them were fatigued did not help.
"We don't have to," Carolyn said.
And he nodded and said, "I know." And he put his arm around her and they sat there a while, thinking about how much they hated this, even as they held on to each other. A one last chance, it felt like. And it was slipping on by. And he was trying to reconcile it, trying to demote it to a place of unimportance in his mind. But even simple things can gain great gravity when you think you might never have a chance for them again. Of course, neither of them would verbalize that possibility. To do so would be to call bad luck down on themselves. So they just sat there, holding on to each other as time ticked by towards 0400, in the dim light of the room with the occasional murmur of someone else's conversations carrying through the walls or through the door as they passed by, and the rumbling, far-off detonations of the air raids and fast movers breaking the sound barrier. You could die, Walter thought, suddenly vehement. And all you'd have as you bled out was that you used the last night to hold her, like an old, impotent couple. It's not a waste, he chastised himself in a half-romantic way. It's a fucking waste, and you know it. And Walter felt himself get angry at everything. And weirdly, oddly, that was what made the difference. Because he knew that if a bullet passed through him, and all the dangerous moments leading up to that one, he would be thinking about the one last opportunity that he'd had to make love to his wife, and how he'd been unable because he was too stressed or too tired or too whacked out of his mind, but none of those excuses would be legitimate in the light of his death. So he turned to her very suddenly and he kissed her mouth, the mouth that he loved so much, and he consciously reined himself in, best to curb that anger that wasn't directed at her necessarily, but just at everything. Best to be gentle. And the lull in his momentum brought back some of the inertia. And so it started out like two kids in the back of a car, awkward and unsure of each other. Slowly, hesitating, doubt-filled. He did not know if she would even want him, and he did not think he could bear that rejection, because he'd feared it for so long, knowing that he'd changed, knowing that he was almost a stranger to her now and she almost a stranger to him. And he, with his scars and his burned face, what would she want with a beat-up old piece of jerky like him? But he couldn't stop himself from touching her. And very surprisingly, she pushed into him. She opened up to him. And her eyes closed, and she breathed in, and she moved in a way that he knew so well, and what it meant. And there and then, they were just themselves, finally, again. And things went very quickly from there. At first, they were intent upon simply navigating around their clothing, but then halfway through, he decided that this was also a waste not to see her body, not to touch her skin, or be skin to skin with her, or put his face to her breasts. So they shucked as much clothing as they could, except for their pants, which couldn't get past their boots, which took too much time to unlace, but that was okay. A minor obstacle in the grand scheme of things. It was a savage sort of love, even as he held back, and perhaps that was why. And he did not think they'd ever experienced this before. Never this manic, never this sad, never this last chance. And afterward, they were both calm, both content, the last chanceness beaten, the opportunity taken, and taken well. And it was only then that either dared to be so stupid as to shatter the moment with speech, and even then they kept it low, kept it quiet, kept it simple. He just told her that he loved her, and she said that she loved him back, and he thought many other things after that, but they would only cheapen it, he knew. So he said nothing more, and neither did she. With the urgency passed, they actually took the time to remove their boots and then their pants, and they lay under the thin blanket of Carolyn's bed with a single light burning against the night, and they stared at dark shadows on the ceiling. They were both quiet for a long time. Walter listened to her breathing. He wondered if he had ever actually listened to it before. It was strange to him, because it was a familiar noise. He knew he could recognize the sound of her quiet breathing, but how he could recognize it he didn't know, because he'd never before paid much attention to it. That breath could be taken away. The thought made him start grinding his teeth again. He didn't want the risk. He didn't want the possibilities. I just want to be left alone with you. But he didn't say that because he did not want to verbalize his concerns. To verbalize them would be to draw them closer to reality. He wanted them floating out there in nebulous darkness. At least when they were there, there was always a chance they might not happen.
We could go away, Walter whispered to the ceiling.
Carolyn's thoughts must have been mirroring his own, because she did not stir or seem to have to change mental gears. She simply asked,
Where would we go?
Walter wasn't sure.
Someplace else. Mexico or Canada, I guess.
They could still find us there.
Yeah, I know.
We have no money, and we wouldn't be able to work.
Maybe we could just live in the mountains or something. You know, survivalist style. We could hunt, grow a little garden.
The only way we can ever be together in peace,
Carolyn said,
is if we win.
Walter put his hands to his forehead, pressed his skin back.
I know.
He relaxed and turned to her, looked at her, and she looked back at him.
I'm just afraid of not making it that far.
She reached up and put one of her warm hands against his face.
We have to try.
I know we do.
She lay back again, the two of them staring at the ceiling again.
Still,
she said,
we may have to go into hiding at some point.
Walter smiled. She was letting them have their moment now. She was letting go of reality for a bit. Screw the facts. Let's build a fantasy.
What about a boat? Walter asked.
A boat?
Yeah. Big boat. Something we could take out to sea. Out into international waters and wait for shit to blow over.
Like a yacht?
A small yacht.
A trawler. Or a sloop.
Do you even know what a sloop is?
Not a clue.
Sounds nice, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chapter 24 Morning came fast. Could you even call it morning? Carolyn moved to the helm of her command, wide awake now after an hour, but still feeling that groggy, sick feeling in her gut that she always felt when she had to wake up at an ungodly hour and actually be operational. Some of it was nerves, too, but she kept that under wraps as much as she could. She took a stem and washed it down with coffee. Then she looked at Carmichael, who watched her with a reserved expression and seemed like he might admonish her again for her usage of the little pills. She held up her free hand to stop him.
Not now.
Carmichael shrugged, looked away.
Who do we have and where are they?
Carmichael had his PD open and he went back and forth between this and the larger monitor that hung between them, turning their faces blue.
I've got four groups reporting so far this morning, he said. The usual early risers. Should be three or four more as time goes on and they get their lazy asses up.
He did something on his own PD and then flipped it to the main monitor, which displayed the usual image of Durham, an image that Carolyn had become intimately familiar with. Four little blue dots appeared on the map. Three were clustered northward at the edge of the red zone. One was a little south and slightly further in the red. Carmichael indicated the topmost cluster of three.
That's 27 fighters there. Decent ones. They'll fan out along the red line and press that shopping district on the other side.
To the lower group.
They only have about five in that group. They're mainly recon. So far, no one is reporting any contact.
Carmichael looked at her.
All quiet this morning.
That didn't make Carolyn feel any better. The groups that she really trusted to back up Walter's assault on the OLC were not checked in at the moment. It was possible that they wouldn't even check in at all. Maybe they'd had enough and left Durham altogether. Or maybe they were just exhausted and sleeping in. Carolyn had thought about communicating with those resistance groups and telling them what she wanted them to do today, but Chief Kozlowski did not want anyone to know about the operation that didn't absolutely need to know. He kept saying OPSEC, and Carolyn didn't like it, but she knew he was right. The more people knew that something was going down this morning, the more chance there was that the COAX would catch wind of it. She looked over to Hughes, who had taken a spot at a table with a collection of computers and monitors, and he had a companion, one of Carolyn's skilled hackers.
Hughes, anything of note?
Hughes looked up and shrugged.
Nothing out of the ordinary. It looks like they plan to move the 7th Street roadblock up and into the red zone about a quarter mile. There'll be some gunship support in that area while they do that, but nothing else.
K-9
Carol and I eyed the map and picked out the 7th Street roadblock, a little yellow bar just outside the red zone. There were no significant resistance forces in that area. She didn't want to lose ground, but the movement of a roadblock wasn't that big of a deal. Let them move their barricades. When the gunships returned to base, they could rocket or mortar the roadblock in the middle of the night.
All right,
Carolyn said.
Keep me posted.
She looked at the clock on her PD. The van that carried the assault team would be circumnavigating the nasty bits of Durham on their way to the OLC. The waypoint that represented the tiny tracking device they'd installed in the van was not visible. It was off the map because it was out of Durham. But she figured they should be about halfway there by now. She thought about contacting them to tell them everything looked good, but they didn't need to know if there were no problems. That was just her desire to trade a few words with Walter. Best to keep the comms free unless there was a problem. She sipped her shitty coffee.
No news is good news,
she breathed to herself. There were too many roadblocks between the red zone and the green zone. However, there weren't that many between Durham and Raleigh. So, while it added a significant chunk of time to their drive, Walter and Kaz had both agreed that the safest bet would be to drive all the way around Durham and slip into the green zone from the direction of Raleigh. There were still roadblocks, but there weren't as many as there were in the center of the city, and that meant they could get around them. And they had pretty good intel on where they were, or at least what Walter hoped was good intel. The intel was only a few days old. Not much would have changed between then and now, right? He shifted in his seat, looked up from the plasma burn that had bubbled up the rubberized floor of the van. He looked across him at Getty, and Getty was solid and calm, as was his usual modus operandi. They exchanged a nod. Walter looked to his right, to the rear of the van. Big van, quite voluminous. Not so much anymore, now that it was jam-packed with 6 new breeds and their gear. The new breeds were uncharacteristically quiet this morning. There had been a few half-hearted attempts at humor. And of course, there was another round of pointing out that they were a dirty dozen, followed by religious supplications. But other than that, the mood had a different feel. It's just a robbery, Walter thought. It's not all that serious. But the silence of the team of new breeds seemed to say the opposite. It was quite serious. Walter supposed they had a point. It was one thing to rob a bank, quite another to rob a federal military installation. Beyond the last pair of new breeds, Kaz and Gibbs, who sat opposite each other with their knees touching, there was a hastily welded framework of I-beams that created a box that was bolted to the interior of the van. It went over a bump and it jostled the van hard. Walter swore and shifted himself back in his seat. There was another wonderful modification. They'd replaced the rear shocks with ones much stiffer. It made for a hell of an uncomfortable ride, but it also made it so that the back end of the van could now support a lot more weight. Sorry, folks, Javon said from the driver's seat, his 5th apology so far. Can't do nothing about it. From the passenger seat, Bobby reached out and patted his shoulder.
You should stop apologizing for it.
Yeah, Monty said sourly. Please stop apologizing for it. Javon chuffed and mumbled to himself. My bad for trying to be polite. They took a left-hand turn. The stiff shocks groaned and creaked.
Turning onto Highway 540,
Bobby said, twisting to project her voice into the back.
About 30 minutes out.
Agent Goring was getting irritable, impatient. He'd requested the goddamn drone flyover a half a fucking hour ago, and still he waited. Did they not realize what was happening? Did they not understand the gravity of this situation? No, probably not. He was one of the few that put stock in the Baucom boys, but that hadn't dissuaded him in his course of action, in his single-minded pursuit of Walter, and it wasn't going to start today. Goring was a bulldog, and when he locked down with his jaws, he wasn't letting go. He fidgeted violently in his seat, his irritation beginning to show and make his companions in the GUV with him uncomfortable.
I want an ETA on that drone,
he said, swiping hastily at his hairline and discovering there was just a bit of sweat there, which only pissed him off more. In the back seat, Agent Barnes sat behind the driver. Between Barnes and the junior agent that was sitting behind Goring's seat and wisely keeping his mouth shut, Macy Stockwell was cuffed with a black hood over her head. She was also wisely keeping her mouth shut. Agent Barnes cleared his throat and twisted. I just called them 5 minutes ago and they said it was 10 minutes. Goring turned in his seat and stared at Barnes. After a few agonizing seconds, Barnes nodded. I'll call them. He flipped up his PD and dialed on private. Goring disliked speakerphone. Yes, Agent Barnes again? Uh-huh.
Just need an ETA on the drone flyover.
Yes, I understand that. Can you just give me the ETA?
Barnes listened, then nodded, then glanced at Goring sheepishly.
It's arriving now. Flyover in 30 seconds.
To whoever was on the other end, Barnes said,
Yes, I'll stay on the line.
Goring smirked, self-satisfied.
See? He said, relaxing into his chair. Squeaky wheel gets the oil.
Barnes gave the play-by-play.
Coming on site now. Okay. Single-family dwelling. No vehicles in driveway. PID on assault team in the woods. Starting the scan.
Now there was a long pause. Barnes stared blankly out the window of the GUV. They were parked in the middle of nowhere. Some dusty truck turnabout several miles from the target. It was pitch black outside. There was nothing to see.
Barnes blinked a few times, then looked at Goring.
Sir, scan's only showing one person inside the house.
Goring's chin jutted out. His jaw muscles bunched.
Then he turned and flipped a finger back and forth between the rookie agent behind him and the Macy girl. The rookie agent jumped into action and speedily ripped the hood off of Macy. Macy's dark hair floated frizzly down to cover her very alarmed face. Cheeks flushed and eyes red with terror-born tears.
What?
She mumbled.
What do you want?
I want to know why there's only one person in that house,
Goring said, his voice simmering with warning. Macy's eyes went even wider. Her mouth dropped open and she started shaking her head.
I don't know. Are you at the right house? Is it the right house?
I don't know, Macy, Goring snapped. Is it?
Yes. I told you the right location.
Then I guess it's the right fucking house.
Goring took a deep breath.
Where is everyone? Why is there only one person in the house? And who the fuck is it?
She was about to say she didn't know, but then she thought better of it and her eyes trailed out the window.
It must be the old man. Pete, I think. He owns the house.
Goring's eyes shot to Barnes for confirmation. Barnes nodded. He'd already done the research on the house. Title and utilities were listed under a Peter something or other. Back to Macy.
Where's Walter Baucom? Goring demanded. Where's the new breeds you claimed were there? Did you make up this entire fucking thing?
No. They were there.
Because if this is some sort of waste of my time, then I've got a special fucking place for you in Sweetwater, Macy, my dear.
It's not a waste of time,
Macy pled.
They must be out doing something.
Doing what?
Goring tapped the center console hard with a single index finger.
Help yourself here, Macy. My patience is really wearing out.
Pete,
she blurted.
Pete will know where they went. Pete is resistance.
Goring thought about how to best handle this situation. He rarely did anything on a whim, but the speed and the rapidity with which he made decisions often gave the appearance of being compulsive. In that moment, he thought about many different courses of action, but only one seemed best to him. He twisted quickly in his seat and reached out with one long, French-cuffed arm and seized Macy Stockwell by the throat in an iron grip. He slammed her head back into the seat and then yanked her closer, and he looked into her eyes and made sure that she saw the blackness in his own.
Are you fucking with me?
His voice was quiet. Terrified, she shook her head as much as she was able, making gagging noises the entire time. He held her there, staring at her. 10 seconds. 20 seconds. When her face had begun to turn purplish and her feet started to shuffle about, he released her, tossing her back into her seat like a bag of trash. She crumpled backwards, gasping for air and coughing, while Agent Barnes and the rookie studiously looked elsewhere.
Get a position on the guy in the house, Goring said, and send the team in. I want this old man alive.
Chapter 25.
Bobby was glued to a monitor.
Turn right at the next intersection, she said.
In the back, Walter felt the van slow down, shift, turn. They threaded their way into Durham, going around the known roadblocks. The route was pre-planned, but Bobby kept herself immersed in the map anyway, just in case an unplanned checkpoint loomed up and she had to navigate them out of there fast. The engine thrummed up again. Another stop. Another intersection. Red light bathed the interior of the cab. It was still dark out. The cab turned green. The van began to accelerate. Javon piloted with care.
It's coming up, Bobby said. Left. Here.
The van slowed again, started turning.
Bobby leaned into the back and looked at Walter.
Turning onto Target Street,
she said, and in her voice was a bit of tension that she was trying to hide. Walter's jaw had begun to ache again from the grinding. He turned to the new breeds.
Everyone copy, turning on Target Street?
Roger that, Kaz said, loud and clear. Everyone, check your mags, check your bolts, check your optics.
There was the sound of shuffling and quiet little metal-on-metal clicks as the new breeds checked their weapons and equipment for the third time that day, once in briefing, once before getting in, and now one last time for good measure.
Clay and Monty, you ready with the welders?
Clay and Monty wagged the spot welders in the air. They looked like bulky pistols with a cylindrical protrusion coming off the back.
We got it, Clay replied.
Kaz nodded.
Harris, you got your goodie bag ready?
Harris patted the satchel which he wore across his chest. It contained pre-measured blocks of plastic explosive, deck cord and blasting caps already installed. Everything packaged and convenient.
Ready to blow some doors down.
Bobby called out from the front.
1 minute out, guys.
1 minute, heard, Kaz responded.
Their communications equipment this time had been garnered from the new breeds, and it included a little wireless transmit button that slid onto the finger of the operator. Walter found it very convenient. You didn't even have to pull your hand off your weapon. He keyed the transmit button that sat on the middle finger of his left hand.
Rabbit to Briar Patch. We're 1 minute out. How we looking?
It was Carolyn's voice that came back.
Everything looks good.
Walter closed his eyes as her voice came through his earpiece. Then he opened them again.
Roger that. Hold traffic.
Walter sat up straight. The heavy canvas bag was strapped to his back, a battle rifle strapped to his chest. He looked at Getty again. The other man looked relaxed. Or maybe he just knew how to fake it.
You ready? Walter asked.
Course,
Getty replied. Walter turned to Kaz.
It's on you.
Kaz squatted in the center between the two benches. Beside him, Gibbs held a manpack launcher.
Slow and steady, Kaz advised.
Six big, helmeted heads nodded.
30 seconds out,
Bobby called.
Eyes on target, Javon said.
Six new breeds reached up and undid the clasp on their battle shrouds and then pulled the ballistic face shield across, connecting it on the opposite side of their helmets. Their faces covered, only their eyes peering out.
Parking lot looks clear, Javon said.
I got a couple of cars, but no occupants. No pedestrians.
Everyone turned to orient themselves toward the rear doors of the van. Straddling the I-beam framework, Kaz had his hands on the back doors of the van. Kaz turned his helmeted head towards Gibbs.
Ready?
Gibbs hugged the launcher to him, checked the readout panel, then nodded.
Ready.
In the front seat, Bobby stowed the map. Walter watched her chest rise and fall as she took a deep breath. Then she reached into the floorboard and came up with a battle rifle. Her eyes were fixed dead ahead.
Parking lot's coming up, Javon narrated for the people in the back.
Still looks clear. We're clear. We're clear. Pulling in. Hang on.
Everyone reached up and took a hold of the canvas straps that had been bolted to the ceiling. The van slowed down. Walter's stomach felt lodged in his throat. He swallowed hard against it, took in a big breath through his nose, and blew it out through pursed lips. The van crept, waiting to turn. Walter could hear the blinker signaling their desire to turn. Tick, 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 tick. Getty reached across, extending his fist to Walter.
Hey.
Walter looked at the fist, then reached across and touched it with his own.
We got this, Getty said.
Yeah.
The van started moving forward.
Here we go,
Javon called, his voice dialed up a few notches. The van hung a left. Walter looked out the windshield. He caught a glimpse of the OLC. The entrance. Wide open entryway. Big enough to fit a van. He turned back.
Focus on the task.
The van bumped over the entrance to the parking lot. Hard. Accelerated for a short distance, then braked. Changed gears. The reverse lights came on. Acceleration again. The tires chirped. Walter clung to his handhold, as did every other member of the entry team. They backed up rapidly. Javon shoved the ass end of the van into the portico of the OLC. At the back, Kaz unlatched the rear doors, letting them open a few inches. Gibbs reached out and grabbed Kaz by the drag strip of his armor to keep him from tumbling out. Kaz watched something out the rear window.
More, more, more. Stop!
Javon slammed on the brakes. The rear doors flew open.
Move!
Kaz shouted. It all happened in a tumble.
8 bodies in the back of a van all surging forward at once. Walter caught a glimpse of the atrium of the OLC and saw the 2 heavily armed Normie soldiers standing with expressions of incomprehension. Kaz spun to the right, pinning the van door open. Gibbs slid to the left, out of view, and shouldered the launcher as he did, out of the way of the van so the back blast didn't toast everyone inside. Poppies! Walter hauled himself forward, Getty to his left, Clay's ass directly in front of him. He saw the streak of white smoke and the shape charge missile smashed into the double doors and simultaneously detonated, sending a cone of superheated pressure and debris lancing through the OLC entrance and ripping apart the 2 guards inside, scattering their pieces across the vestibule. Into the smoke. Into the acrid fire. Walter reached the edge of the van and hopped down. He hit the concrete and almost stumbled. Felt Getty's hand on his shoulder, keeping him upright. He touched off his comms. On the ground. They moved forward. The stink of high explosive. Someone was yelling. The 4 new breeds held at the breached entrance. Gibbs! Kaz yelled. You're up! Gibbs again, dipping through the entrance, immediately followed by Kaz. Gibbs slipped left again, Kaz slipped right. Walter saw into the entryway, into the shielded rotunda, and the 2 guards inside. One shouted something into a comm unit, while the other reached for something on the desk panel. The big red handle. To put the OLC into lockdown. The guard hit it a second before Gibbs fired the 2nd shape charge missile. The lights in the OLC all went red. There was supposed to be a warning klaxon, but Walter didn't hear it over the firing of the missile and the subsequent explosion, which carved a red-hot mouth in the rotunda and turned the 2 guards inside to mush. The 4 remaining new breeds poured through the mangled ruins of the OLC doors and into the entryway. They moved, controlled, a brisk walking pace. But there was the sound of stamping boots, the squeak of them on polished floors. Another shout. Clay's rifle pivoted and spat fire. Out of the corner of his eye, Walter watched a 3rd guard topple to the ground on boneless legs and then start rolling in agony. Clay took 2 steps towards the man and put a single round into the back of his head. Walter and Getty were at the breach in the doors. He heard the warning klaxons now. He turned and looked at the van just as the massive blast doors started coming down out of the ceiling, descending on the tail end of the van. Sheet metal crunched, screeched. The motors of the blast doors roared loud, straining. The groan of steel. The back end of the van dipped low, but the newly installed shocks held and the solid core tires didn't pop. The blast doors stopped their advance. The I-beam frame that they'd bolted to the interior of the van had done its job. Let's go, Walter huffed. He spun and slipped through the breach behind Getty. The vestibule was a big square, now smoking and bloody and in ruin. In the center of the square was the shattered rotunda, speckled on the interior with gore. To the left, there were 2 sets of doors as well as an elevator. Clay and Monty were at the doors, and lightning-bright sparks leapt around them, and the spot welders crackled and spat like fighting cats as the 2 new breeds hurriedly welded the doors closed. The welds would hold reinforcements off, but not forever. This needed to happen fast. To Walter's right was the 1 door that mattered, the door to the offices, which was where the money was kept. At that 1 all-important door, Harris knelt, activating a breaching pack that he'd already stuck like a block of putty to the door just above the latching mechanism. Off to the right of the door, Kaz and Gibbs were stacked up. Gibbs had already slung the manpack launcher onto his back and was armed now with his rifle. Harris stood up and jogged away from the door. Control! He shouted, slipping in behind Gibbs. The 3 new breeds dipped their heads. Away in 3, 2, 1. Carolyn stood in agonized silence. She stood in front of the projection. She stood with her arms wrapped tightly around herself and her jaw set and her eyes fixed on the target building and the little waypoint that represented the van. Walter's last words reverberated hard inside of her. Boots on the ground. Jesus, what if those were his actual last words? She wished for audio or video or some connection to see what the hell was happening during the assault and then decided that it would only haunt her forever if something went wrong. The seconds ticked by. Stretched. Meandered. Fuck. How long did it take? 30 seconds now. Were they inside? When the hell was Walter going to give her a status update? Carolyn searched avidly for something else to pay attention to. Her eyes shot around the map projection and decided to latch on to the little icons of the 2 resistance groups that had checked in 20 minutes ago. 2 of the groups that she actually trusted to be well-trained enough and well-equipped enough to back up the assault team if necessary. She jabbed a finger at the icons.
Murray and Zev haven't fucking moved,
she stated, overly loud.
Why aren't they moving? We told them to get into the yellow zone 20 minutes ago. They're still in the red zone. They're still...
She glanced to Carmichael, who she was actually speaking to, and realized that he had one finger in his ear trying to hear something that someone on his PD was saying. Carolyn felt a flash of anger that heated the back of her neck. She opened her mouth to call Carmichael.